welcome to Fetch the Smelling Salt. I'm Alice Nagel.
And I'm Kimberly Marsh, and this is our podcast, all about historical dramas from movies and TV shows from every era and all around the world.
Yay!
Yay! And today,
we have a doozy.
Yes, a long one, but so much fun to watch. Well, rewatch.
Really fun. I feel like we both really wanted to watch this one and do this one, but you were the one who brought it up. Like, you picked it, right?
Yes. Yeah, quite a while back. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We didn't even tell them what it is. It's Amadeus.
Amadeus.
Yes. It's Amadeus for the fourth time. And I totally did not realize that it was released in, what, 1984?
Yes, it was released in 1984. The year
that's
of my birth.
That's crazy. I mean, I don't know. I just totally didn't realize it. You know what I mean? Like, I thought it was like something from the 90s.
Well, when was the first time you watched it?
I think I was quite old, actually. It must have been, it must have been late 90s, you know? I know it's funny like that, but I have a feeling. Again, right, I go by which house was I living in. Yeah. So I was living in a flat that we moved into around the time I was like 11 going on 12, right? So that was already in the 90s. So yeah, it was like mid-90s, I think I watched it. So I just somehow had it in my head. It was a 90s movie. 1984.
Yeah, I grew up watching this movie at my grandparents' house. So I have a few family members who are very serious musicians and into classical music. And I grew up listening to classical music, not that I know very much about it. But it was always kind of part of the background. And this movie was part of that background tapestry as well. So I had a really strong memory of the first half hour of this film and the second half hour of this film.
Right.
And the middle 8 hours are kind of a blur.
Yeah. I definitely did not remember it being this long. So it's about, 2 hours, 40 minutes? And even longer if you watch the director's cut, which is about 3 hours, which I did not watch. I watched the theatrical release version. It was long, but it's long, but it's great. It's great. It's beautiful. It made me feel better about my laugh.
You have a great laugh.
I have a horribly obnoxious laugh, but it's okay. It's me. It's my laugh. It's fine. People make fun of it, but whatever. It's me.
You sound like a beautiful, vindictive witch when you laugh.
Aww. All right, I like that. But yeah, this laugh is amazing. It is so iconic. It is classic. It is wonderful. So I felt very happy. My heart was content listening to his laugh.
Should we summarize this long-ass movie?
Yes.
And so, then talk about it?
All right, sure. Let's do that. Bear with. It is a long summary, but I'll try to get through it. And you know me. I talk fast. Okay.
You talk way faster than me.
Vienna, 1823. And the film opens with a voice crying out, "Mozart, forgive your assassin!" Okay. We soon find out the source of that cry, composer Antonio Salieri, who is quickly committed to a psychiatric hospital after a suicide attempt and professing to have killed Mozart. So a priest, Father I'm just going to call him the priest, comes to visit him, and Salieri plays pieces of music to find out his musical knowledge. Sadly, priesty dude isn't familiar with any of Salieri's own compositions, but he immediately recognizes an iconic melody from Mozart, Ein Klein Nacht Musik. This obviously annoys Salieri, who begins to recount the story of his life and how it intertwined with that of Mozart. So as a young child, Salieri always wanted to be a composer, but was prevented from pursuing music by his overbearing father. Once his father dies, an incident which Salieri deems an act of God, he is free to pursue his dreams and eventually ends up as a court composer to Emperor Joseph II in Vienna. So meanwhile, we see a very young Mozart being nurtured in his talent by his own father. This leads him to perform at, European courts and even for the Pope. He lands a patronage by the Prince Archbishop of Salzburg, and his reputation has reached the ears of Salieri, who attends a reception at Sid, Prince Archie's, you know, fancy-ass pad. And because he's curious to find out more about Mozart, whom he, at this point, he kind of idolizes. So while sneaking away to check out the reception food.
Yes, and this is where we get our one and only pheasant sighting
of the film. Oh, pause!
They hang out a pheasant on a plate, which is probably fine. He's not dead at all. He's just
chilling
on a plate.
Yeah, chilling on a plate. So pheasant's chilling on a plate. I mean, I can't blame Salieri. If I'm in a boring-ass party, I'll totally go scope out the food, right? That's what he does.
Yeah.
So he comes across this wholly ridiculous scene in which, like, Mozart is running around, like, literally running around with his lover, Constance. And it is only when Mozart heads out to conduct the little chamber orchestra playing his music that Salieri realizes who he was. And he is now totally disgusted. So the emperor, who is, you know, Salieri's boss, essentially, also comes to hear of Mozart and invites him to his court. Salieri writes a march in honor of Mozart's honor, but the letter inadvertently insults Salieri by suggesting ways to improve on it. Quite a dick move, I would say.
Iconic. Oh.
I know. He's like, oh, actually, you could do it like this. Doo-doo-doo-doo. Or that. Doo-doo-doo-doo. Yeah. So Salieri is like pissed because, you know, Mozart and his dick move. Meanwhile, Emperor commissions an opera from Mozart, and one of Salieri's students, a soprano singer called Caterina, whom Salieri was infatuated with, lands the key role. At the opening night, Emperor comes on stage to congratulate Mozart on his success, and there is a suggestion that Caterina and Mozart may have had some sort of an affair, or at least that's how Salieri like chooses to see it. You know,
this is where I lose a lot of sympathy for Salieri when he's just like, I didn't touch her, I didn't want her, but
I know
she couldn't
go. No one else can.
Like soiling herself with that dude.
Yeah, exactly. And then meanwhile, right, we are introduced to Constance again, and she's now, you know, Mozart's fiance. So again, all of this fuels Salieri's jealousy and rage, right? So he's like, poof. So now settled in Vienna, Mozart indulges in his spendthrift and frivolous ways, lots of laughing, lots of spending, lots of strutting around, leading poor Constance, or Stanzi, as he calls her, to plead with Salieri to help her husband get work from the emperor. She even sneaks pieces of Mozart's work off to him, and this makes him even more enraged when he sees that Mozart didn't even have to make corrections in his musical sheets. Everything was so brilliantly composed in his head. So, you know, that's quite sad. So meanwhile, Mozart's father has arrived to try to straighten him out. So dodging
Papa.
His father's... Papa has arrived. So he's like, you know, the father's like, what's happening? You know, you owe all this money. Tell me about it. And he's like, no, let's go party instead. So he takes Papa and Stanzi to this little masquerade party, where his father dons this really cool like costume of his like two-faced dark figure. And then Mozart has an amazing unicorn costume. Okay, I want that so bad.
It was a unicorn?
I think so. Yeah.
I thought it was just a horse head.
I think maybe I was hallucinating. Maybe I wanted it to be a unicorn so much.
You just see unicorn horns.
I see unicorn horns. Yep, exactly. It's like, woohoo. Anyway, he had a cool little, you know, thing. But probably not as cool
as this. It is a unicorn.
It's a unicorn. I'm going to say it's a unicorn. It is canon now.
Mm-hmm.
So, unbeknownst to Mozart, Salieri is also at this party. And he sees Mozart publicly mocking him. You know, which he takes as God himself mocking him. So he's enraged.
He's not even in a good disguise.
Yeah, exactly. He's like one of those,
like,
you know,
in a little mask.
Yeah.
With a stick on it.
You don't
know. He's like, I'm not Salieri.
God, I know. So he's like, oh, I hate you, God. I'm going to, you know, take my revenge by taking revenge on Mozart, who is your favorite. So I like his little logic there. So Mozart, unfortunately, continues down on his destructive road of alcoholism, leading to, you know, the destruction of his health, his finances, his reputation at court. One day, a maid played by Cynthia Nixon, a young Cynthia Nixon of Sex and
looking
the City fame.
Looking a full, like, 40 years old.
I know.
As a teenager. She was like 17 when she did this. I think she was definitely underage.
So weird. So yeah, so, you know, Cynthia Nixon, the maid, appears at Mozart's door, claiming to have been sent by this mysterious benefactor. So it doesn't take much for us viewer audience to realize who that benefactor is. Salieri, of course, who has hired this maid to basically spy on Mozart. Desperate for some help, Stanzi, you know, pleads with her husband to take her on board, you know, free help, why not? So one day when Mozart and Stanzi are out of the house, the maid sneaks Salieri in to snoop around. So he finds a score of a new opera that Mozart is composing, The Marriage of Figaro, and begins to formulate another plan, a cunning plan. So now, because the play, The Marriage of Figaro, has been banned by the emperor because of its supposedly subversive themes, Salieri is able to engineer Mozart being summoned to court. But much to his dismay, Mozart manages to convince the emperor to not only allow him to perform the opera, but eventually to even include a ballet, which, you know, as part of it, which the emperor for some reason hates. Anyway, all this happens. One day, Mozart comes home to find that his father had died. Dear old papa. So to deal with his grief, he composes Don Giovanni, which I've seen, by the way. So I've seen Marriage of Figaro, and I've seen Don Giovanni.
I haven't seen Don Giovanni, but Don Giovanni in this film was performed in the Prague Opera House, which is where it was first performed. And I've seen an opera at the Prague Opera House when I was living in Prague, but it was Rusalka, which is a Dvorak opera, which is like the Little Mermaid, basically.
Oh, cool. Wow. So I saw Don Giovanni when I was in Verona, in like the basically what is like the Verona version of the Colosseum. It was so cool. Anyway, despite his efforts to sabotage the opera's success, Salieri admits that he could not help but attend every one of its performances. He does, however, have a light bulb moment when he realizes that the dead commander in the opera is symbolic of Mozart's father and the influence that he still has on his son, even from beyond the grave. This kind of puts in motion his later scheme, in which he disguises himself.
He's always scheming.
He's always scheming. Gosh. You know, so he's like, ha, I'm going to put on this costume, the same costume Mozart's father had worn, right? And then he goes, I just don't get this, right? He just puts on this costume. He goes to Mozart's door. I don't think he's even trying to disguise his voice.
No, not at all. He's like, sorry, hi, like, I'm not Salieri.
I'm not. Like,
I'm mysterious.
Exactly, you know. But Mozart, like, you know, probably drunk out of his mind anyway, sees him, understandably shaken, and even more so when Salieri in disguise commissions a Requiem Mass from him. So, you know, that kind of like shakes Mozart to the core, because his plan, as he reveals to us, audience and priest, is to kill Mozart when the piece is finished and to premiere it at Mozart's funeral and basically say, haha, this is my brilliant work. All of this is wonderful. His only problem is how to actually kill Mozart. So meanwhile, Mozart's friend, performer Emmanuel Schikaneder,
just say Simon Callow because it's Simon Callow.
Yeah, Simon Callow. You know, we love him. Simon Callow basically not only puts up a vaudeville version of Don Giovanni, but even tries to convince Mozart to write an entirely new opera for his theatre. Stanzi isn't too thrilled because, you know, Simon Callow isn't going to pay up front, and instead offers Mozart half the takings, but Mozart eventually agrees. As time passes, His behavior gets more and more erratic. He neglects the Requiem and concentrates on this new opera he's trying to write. This frustrates Sanzi because she just doesn't understand why he wouldn't work for ready money. Eventually, she has enough of it all and leaves him, taking their son with her. Even the maid abandons him, telling Salieri that, dude, I just can't deal with this. This is all nuts.
I'm frightened.
I'm so frightened. Oh. So, right. Mozart, you know, he does complete the opera, which we now know as the Magic Flute.
So crazy that
I know.
This vaudeville that Simon Callow is trying to get him to write as like just a silly little comedy by a ragtag team of opera makers is the Magic Flute, like one of the most famous, well-known things.
Exactly.
And sorry, small aside.
Yep.
So we have trick-or-treaters come every year. We live in Scotland, so they're called geysers.
Mm.
And the difference between geysing and regular trick-or-treating is in Scotland, the kids are expected to tell a joke or perform a little dance or a silly song or something to entertain in order to earn their treats.
It's amazing.
So we have a little group of kids in the neighborhood who go around to, you know, the same people every year in a group. And for like 3 years in a row, we've got this one absolute legend of a little girl who sings the aria
from
the Magic Flute. You know, I won't attempt it, but she does it and she nails it.
Bloody hell.
And I just look at, for 3 years running on Halloween, I just look at her in awe and I'm just like, take all the candy. Some cash. Here are my earrings. You're so brilliant.
Oh, man. I'm going to try to like, maybe you can try to encourage this to be the kiddies who come to my house next year. I'll be like, sing for me, child.
Yeah.
Specifically this.
Sing me an aria, child.
Sing me a child. It's like, and then I get an egg thrown in my face. So so it's a Magic Flute. Great success. However, the now poor, overworked, and clearly sickly Mozart collapses during a performance and Salieri has him taken home to rest. So his opera friends, you know, come to visit him and check in on him. But Mozart doesn't notice because Salieri pretends that the visit is from the mysterious costume, you know, what I call the mysterious costume man. That is what I'm calling him, mysterious costume man. He's like, no, it is not them. It is me, mysterious costume man.
I mean, not me.
Not me, totally not me. It is that dude who came and gave you some money. So Mozart's like, right. You know, so he tells Mozart, look, here's some money that mysterious costume man gave you. You now, if you finish the Requiem by tomorrow night, you're going to get more money. And so he's essentially pushing Mozart, you know, even more. So poor, brilliant Mozart's like, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to finish this Requiem. And Salieri basically offers to help him. And so what Mozart does is, you know, compose this brilliant part, this last bit of the Requiem. And meanwhile, Salieri writes. And as it goes on and on, you kind of see this little, you know, like relationship grow and Salieri's getting more and more like into Mozart. And Mozart's like, oh, Salieri, I was so wrong. I thought you hated me. I thought you hated my music.
It's so sad. This is what they could have had all along.
Exactly. Because, you know, he appreciates Mozart's genius, you know. But he's just so up himself, right? Anyway, Mozart says, right, I'm going to take a wee break. I'm going to take a nap. And Stanzi somehow has a premonition. So she's over at the spa. And she's like, oh, I have to go home. I have to go home to Vienna. So she's coming home. She comes home. And the next morning, she's like, who the hell are you? You know, to see Salieri. He wakes up. He's like, yeah, no, I was here. I'm here helping Mozart. So she's like, nope, get out. You know, Mozart is sick. I don't want you here. Just get out. And I don't want him to work on this Requiem anymore because it's making him sick. Anyway, they argue. While they argue, Mozart has kind of fallen back to sleep again, this time the eternal sleep. So he dies, everyone's sad. The next scene is even sadder because you kind of see his body being brought up in his coffin and essentially being dumped in a common grave. And now we kind of flash back forward, you know, and we're back in what, quote unquote, present day. Salieri is fed up because he's like, right, even in death, you know, Mozart wins and God wins because I couldn't get what I wanted. You know, I'm like, Mozart gets to die and everyone remembers him and I had to live this life and watch my music be slowly forgotten. And he calls himself the saint of mediocrity, which cracked me up. And then he's just wheeled off to his breakfast and bath. And the film ends with the lovely peal of laughter from Mozart. The end.
Standing ovation! Woo! First of all, I listened to so many podcasts about Mozart in preparation for this. I have more information about Mozart than I could ever need. I've read letters of his, like saucy letters to his cousin with poop jokes. But I can recommend the sources. The main sources that I used were a BBC podcast called Composer of the Week with Donald MacLeod. And I mostly used a particular one from 2021, which is specifically about Mozart's final 5 years, including his death.
Okay.
And an article from BBC Culture from 2015, which was around the 30th anniversary, by Clemency Burton Hill. And a really shockingly negative 2009 Guardian review by a historian called Alex von Tunzelmann.
Dude, Alex, why are you going to be a hater?
Who was so down on this movie, gave it like a D. Wild, absolutely shocking. And so first of all, this movie, if anyone doesn't know, came out in 1984, and at the 1985 Oscars, absolutely ate. It ate everybody and everything.
Yep. It swept. It cleaned up, right? Yeah.
Cleaned the house. So it got 8 Oscars for Best Picture, Actor, for F. Murray Abraham, who plays Salieri, got the Best Actor Oscar, which is funny because unusually, both Tom Hulce, who plays Mozart, and F. Murray Abraham were nominated for Best Actor. So two actors, lead actors from the same movie, nominated for Best Actor. And it was Salieri who won the Oscar.
Oh, Salieri, are you happy now?
Yeah. It also won for Best Director for Miloš Forman, Best Writing, like Screenplay Adaptation for Paul Schaeffer, Best Art Direction, Costume Design, Sound, and Makeup. In addition to that, it won BAFTAs. It won loads of international awards. It won a total of 43 awards that year.
Oof.
I also have to say that I thought, I was at Tesco the other day, and I thought, will I try to get some kind of wine or something that has anything to do remotely with the podcast today, like something Mozart-related? Something maybe with like a, you know, an 18th century like portrait on it.
Yeah. And what did you get?
Well, I was passing by and I saw this bottle of wine, right? And I thought, is that Snoop Dogg? So I had to look at it and I reached for it. But it is winter here. I was wearing a big puffy jacket. And the bottle I tried to grab, I dropped. And I took out like a really cheap ass barefoot Malbec on the way down. So I broke 2 bottles of red wine all over the floor at Tesco. And the lady who came to help me was really, really nice about it. But that I figured like, this is the voice of God telling me that I have to buy this wine. It is Snoop Dogg's wine. I'm not sure exactly what it what that means, but it's called Cali Red. It has Snoop Dogg's face on it. To be fair, he is a great composer of our time.
Exactly. So there we go.
And so that is how God led me to this Snoop Dogg Cali Red. It is full-bodied and both fruity and woody and mature. I recommend it.
All right, I'm going to check it out.
Will I post a picture on our Instagram? Sure.
I don't know, man. Come on, Snoop Dogg. I mean, he might like it.
Mozart wine. It's the Amadeus wine. If you're watching Amadeus, you should be drinking Snoop Dogg's Cali Red.
Totally. Meanwhile, guess what I found?
It's a fucking unicorn.
It is.
Look at that horn.
I was right.
It's gilded. And it's beautiful.
Yep. So, listeners, I looked up to find out whether the costume that Mozart wore, was it a horse, a unicorn? And it was a unicorn. Beautiful. You know what? That's what I'm going to be wearing for Halloween. And then I'm going to go, you know, like rock up to like random people's houses and start singing the aria from the magic flute.
I won't stop until they give me
candy. And I'll sing so badly, they're just going to be throwing shit at me. It'll be perfect. All right, carry
on.
It might
not be candy, but they'll throw something. So there's been a lot said about the historical accuracy of Amadeus. It's obviously an incredible film, and I'll tell you some really great stuff about the production of the film, which to me just added to the depth of how brilliant it is. But people have said it's not considered a biopic of Mozart. It shouldn't be considered biographical. It's not historically accurate because this rivalry between Mozart and Salieri never really existed. But I think Clemency Burton Hill from the BBC Culture article from 2015 summed up Amadeus best when she calls it arguably the finest movie ever made about the process of artistic creation and the unbridgeable gap between human genius and mediocrity, unquote. So some people got it and some people don't. So historians who say that the film is historically inaccurate, like, don't seem to take into account the history of, like, the story itself of this rivalry between Mozart and Salieri, because that's not something that the film Amadeus or Miloš Forman, its director, just like plucked out of thin air. There's a really long history to that. And I think, like, as period drama watchers, we tend to forgive historical inaccuracies, like, depending on what the changes to history actually do. So in our episode about Emily, we were not keen on the changes made to, like, history or, like, the biography of Emily Bronte because they did everybody dirty.
Yeah.
Whereas in this film, so the premise of the film, I feel, isn't so much, like, the rivalry between Mozart and Salieri, but it's, like, this brilliant allegory of genius versus mediocrity. And so that allegory does depend on the premise that, one, Salieri had no chill and he never touched a butt. And two, Mozart had this, like, divine super talent inside the body of an emotionally stunted little dweeb.
Yes.
So one is definitely not true. Salieri had a wife and he had 8 kids. So he did touch a butt. At least one. And he was rumored to have at least one mistress on top of that.
Yeah, I read somewhere that he was the one who actually, you know, had an affair with Caterina, but, right? The person whom he was, like, you know, all pissed off about.
Yeah, the one singing in The Marriage of Figaro.
Yeah.
She actually was rumored to be his lover.
Yeah.
So, too, that Mozart was a super talented, like, divinely inspired little nerd. That was kind of true. But before I get into the history of Mozart I want to talk about the history of the story and the rumor of the rivalry between Mozart and Salieri.
Okay, that's really cool. All right.
Just to see how we get from actual, like, Mozart and Salieri in the flesh to the movie Amadeus. Because there's this really interesting road that we take to get there. So it starts when the movie is set in the 1780s in Vienna. There is a real rivalry between German and Italian, like, schools of music. And you see this a little bit in the film where Mozart is, like, complaining about Italian musicians. Like, oh, everything's Italian. Oh, the Italians. The Italian musicians. And I imagine that they'd, like, get together and they'd have little opera battles.
Oh!
German and Italian.
Yep.
And Salieri, he's from Italy, so he's
so it's like the original Pitch Perfect thing.
No, exactly. Except you've got people in the corner, like, writing the arias.
Yeah.
And then handing it to the soloists. Being like, yeah, go. So Salieri was Italian, so he's considered part of the Italian crew. But, you know, this is also a community of composers where people were inspired by each other. They borrowed from each other. There were friendly rivalries. And as far as we know, Mozart and Salieri just kind of existed in that space together. But they were definitely considered on opposite crews. Where the actual rumor that Salieri killed Mozart seems to have come from is in 1823. So this is long after Mozart's death. Salieri, as an old man, has an emotional breakdown and kind of a mental break with reality. He becomes delusional and says a whole bunch of stuff, including that he killed Mozart. And then later, when he comes back to himself, you know, he says that's not true. That was part of a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And then Salieri went on to die in 1825. In 1830, a guy called Alexander Pushkin really latched on to this rumor. I guess they found out about this kind of, like, delusional claim that Salieri had killed Mozart. And he writes this short play called Mozart and Salieri, in which the character Salieri kills Mozart in the end. Then in 1898, you get Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, who is famous for The Flight of the Bumblebee. You know that one?
Yep.
So he turned Pushkin's play into an opera, also called Mozart and Salieri. Fast forward to 1979, we get the premiere of Peter Schaeffer's play Amadeus, which is based on this opera. And Peter Schaeffer also wrote the screenplay for Amadeus because Milos Forman, who would direct Amadeus, went to this production in 1979, in which, guess who played Mozart?
Who?
Simon Callow.
No!
That's right. Other actors who have played Mozart in the production of the play Amadeus include Tim Curry.
Oh.
And Mark Hamill.
Oh, okay.
Tim Curry did it for a long time as well, which I can totally see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark Hamill is a fun one as well. I would like to have seen that. Simon Callow. So you can see there's this really brilliant historical through line from Mozart and Salieri's day, like their lives as composers and musicians, through to the film Amadeus. And I think that's one of the things that makes the film so brilliant is you're not just getting like this twisted kind of biography of Mozart that some people seem to think it is, but you're actually getting a bit of history from that time period.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And, like, from that time period through to now.
That is super cool. That's amazing.
And as well, I think, like, apart from this, this movie dives into so much of the history of the late 18th century Europe that we don't see a lot of. I think from that era, especially from continental Europe, it's all about royalty, which can be really fun.
And patronage.
The costumes are amazing. Yeah, but you don't get as much about I mean, forget about common people. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the closest we're going to get is these really famous composers. But to get this kind of glimpse into the classical music scene and everything that was going on and everything that went into being a musician, I think is just like, we don't have many period dramas that are like that.
Yeah.
So can I tell you some really interesting things about this production?
Oh, yes, please.
Of the film. So a lot of music is played in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And some professors of music have analyzed the film and looked really closely at it and came to the conclusion that not one key is struck incorrectly when compared to what is heard at the exact same moment in the film.
That's bananas.
So what that means is everybody who is playing an instrument is actually mm-hmm. playing it and actually playing those notes that you see on camera,
yeah.
which might sound simple, but is so hard to do in film.
No.
Especially considering these actors, Tom Hulce, who's playing Mozart,
mm-hmm.
did not know how to play piano when he was cast mm-hmm. as Mozart. And he spent 6 hours a day for 6 months learning how to play the piano and every single piece of music that was in the film, including the scene at the party where he's dressed like a unicorn and he's
plays it
playing
backwards.
Beethoven, like, and he's upside down playing that Beethoven that is really him playing it in real time.
That is, oh my God, it blows my mind.
Incredible. And F. Murray
Abraham.
And now
he knows a party trick.
Exactly. He probably does it still at every single party. I would.
Yeah, he'll say, all right,
you're kidding. I'd be like, get me upside down to the nearest pianoforte.
Mm-hmm.
And F. Murray Abraham, who plays Salieri, he doesn't do as much playing music, but he mm-hmm. also learned to read music and conduct music for his role.
Wow.
I already mentioned that they filmed at the Prague Opera House. They filmed mm-hmm. everything in Prague, which is a good place to film in the 80s because it was under communist rule. It was under the Soviet Union. And so you didn't get as much, I guess, modern additions to the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's historically significant because Mozart did spend a lot of time in Prague and he premiered Don Giovanni in Prague at the Prague Opera House. Everything was also shot in natural light. So not only in natural sunlight, but also in candlelight. They used no extra lights. They used like diffusers and things like that and mirrors and stuff, but they used no like spotlights or anything like that, like extra lighting. It was all natural light. As a period drama watcher, that mm-hmm. is huge.
Yeah.
That you would get like that real feeling of historical ambiance and lighting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To add to that, we already know that this won for best costume. All of the sets, like the opera sets, and mm-hmm. all of the costumes that you see in the operas were based on sketches of original costumes and sets that were used when the operas premiered.
I mean, wait, what I want to know is, was there really, you know, was there someone in the 18th century running around in that unicorn outfit? Who is this person? And can their ghost come back and talk to me?
So the one thing I've seen criticized was that the wigs weren't very historically accurate. You've mm-hmm. got this really like fuzzy
this
pink
spiky
wig
yeah.
that Mozart wears. So I don't know if that applies as well to the unicorn head, but I'm going to believe 18th century unicorns.
For sure.
Going around. Of course. It was probably the most common costume of mm-hmm. 1890. I know that you're really interested in accents.
Ooh, yes.
You might have noticed that a lot of the actors are speaking in American accents.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on purpose. There's like a whole accent convention that's being employed here. So people who are speaking with American accents are native German speakers. And non-American accents are foreigners. The IMDb says literally, non-American accents are foreigners, even if the accent doesn't match the actual language. So, for example, that's why Simon Callow, who is a British actor, is speaking with an American accent, even though he's British, but he's supposed to be German, so he's speaking with an American accent.
Right. So it's like watching Allo Allo.
What is that?
Oh my god! Okay, Allo Allo. It's a BBC like series. Okay, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
Okay.
It's set in World War II France, where essentially the people who speak in French accents are speaking French. And anyway, there's a British guy, there's a British dude, but when he speaks really bad English, that is basically to show that he's trying to speak French.
Oh, okay.
And he's speaking it really bad. And then when he's not speaking French, quote unquote, and he's speaking just English, he goes back to his like regular, you know, proper way of speaking, like, you
right.
know, like grammatically correct English. But he has his British, yeah.
So there are other actors in Amadeus who are speaking with like British accents, but they're mm-hmm. supposed to be Italian. But that's to indicate to the viewer that they're foreign.
Oh.
But then F. Murray Abraham, playing Salieri, is American, and he's basically speaking with an American accent, but mm-hmm. he puts like a little bit of an Italian...
Yeah, like a generic European suave accent.
On it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was on purpose. So you've got, at one point, you've got Simon Callow, a British actor, speaking with an American accent, playing an Italian character in a Don Giovanni parody.
Oh my god. It's just too much for my little brain to handle. Yeah.
So that is what made this film so incredible and why it won so many Oscars mm-hmm. in so many categories. When it comes to the history of Mozart, I've already talked about how we've got this history of the rivalry that we see mm-hmm. in the film. And I've said that the characterization of Salieri is basically wrong because he's an allegory. He's supposed to represent this kind of like the ungifted side. He's had to mm-hmm. work for everything, for all of his talent, because he had this passion for music, whereas mm-hmm. Mozart just kind of had it. And he's supposed to represent the gifted, mm-hmm. the touched by God, the prodigy. Mm-hmm. So we know that Salieri wasn't that shriveled husk of a celibate dude who was really mm-hmm. bitter toward Mozart. He touched his wife's butt.
Yes.
And probably someone else's butt. And Mozart, was he an emotionally stunted little dweeb? Kinda. He was a child prodigy.
Yes.
Who toured Europe. And he did entertain royalty with his father and his sister, who is also a musical prodigy. We didn't get to see her.
Yeah.
But he didn't just scribble down like perfect music in one go. He wrote lots of drafts. He made references to the work of his contemporaries, like his fellow composers, and he had plenty of composer friends. His bestie was Haydn. If that means anything.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's nice. I'm happy for him.
But he was super silly, and he liked crude and gross humor, which Paul Schaeffer knew about through Mozart's surviving letters.
Oh, yes, the letters which you read or had read to you.
Which I did read. You can find some of them online, and I'll post some of them to our Instagram, but they're very funny.
Ooh,
when I read them, I thought about reading one, but mm-hmm. I couldn't do it justice because when I read them, all I hear is Hugh Laurie's voice.
Oh.
Like Hugh Laurie as the Prince Regent from Blackadder. Because that's exactly what he sounds like.
Oh my god.
So he was a silly dude. He was a little dude. He was known for being short and like not much to look at. But mm-hmm. apparently when he was conducting his music or playing music, like his face just lit up and he had this glow, this attraction mm-hmm. about him, you know?
Yeah.
He was a really like compelling dude.
Mm.
He also in the film is shown being really bad with money because he's wasting it on parties and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, Mozart was bad with money and he did take on debt. But to be fair to him, he wasn't as irresponsible with money as he's made out to be. Like he borrowed money. Here's the thing. So he borrowed money to dress and live like an upper class man. Mm-hmm. Which was this weird thing about being a composer in Vienna at the time, is that you didn't have to come from the upper class, but to be taken seriously, you might want to, like Mozart really wanted to feel like and look like and live like he was mm-hmm. part of the aristocracy, you know, in order to become a court composer and to be taken seriously and to run in these circles. And he was known for this, like, ostentatious dress as well.
No, I can understand that.
Yeah. There's, like, a red velvet coat that he wears at one point in the film, which I think mm-hmm. is taken from reports of him wearing this, like, shocking red outfit.
Ooh, nice.
So he did spend money on things like clothes and stuff for his house.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't shy away from work. He took on, like, any work that he could. And a lot of his debt was to either put on his own operas or to pay for his wife Constanza's medical treatments because she was often in poor health, and he would send her on trips to Baden, which was the mm-hmm. spa town. So in the film, when she leaves him and goes to Baden because she's mad about him spending all of his money and being an alcoholic, that never happened. But she often went on trips to Baden that he would pay for to receive medical treatment, because it's basically the bath of you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Yeah. She's going to take the waters. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they're as gross as the waters in Bath.
Ugh.
I would like a Jane Austen adaptation set in Baden.
Oh, yeah. That would be cool.
Aside. I also, if we have time, want to come back to Constanza because she is a bad bitch.
Ooh.
Absolutely. So, additionally, in the film, we see mm-hmm. Salieri coming to be this mysterious figure to commission the Requiem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also kind of based in reality. So there was a mysterious figure who did anonymously commission the Requiem, but he didn't come Ooh. In a costume being like,
I am not Salieri.
So he probably did it via a letter or a messenger or something. But it wasn't Salieri. It was a guy called Count Franz von Walsegg, who was
a
count. No, it does not sound real. And he was kind of a larger-than-life guy. He mm-hmm. was notorious for being an amateur musician who would commission works from composers and then pass them off as his own work. There was a huge problem with plagiarism in the classical period, which you can see why, because people would try to sell their work, but then once it's out there, it's just on paper. You can't prove that it's yours, and people would change it a little bit and then say they wrote it.
Yeah.
Which was Salieri's plan for the Requiem. It was also Count Franz von Walsegg's plan for the Requiem. But he was commissioning it for his wife, who tragically died. She was only 21, and he was much, much older. And she passed away. He wanted this beautiful Requiem in her honor. And Mozart did die before finishing the Requiem. But he did know that he probably knew that it was the Count who wanted it.
I am not the Count.
I'm not the Count. I'm just picturing, like, him with a mustache painted on his finger.
And a monocle.
Holding it up under his nose. My name is Count Bonds von Balsig. And I want a requiem for my not wife.
Yeah.
My dog.
Who's very much alive.
My wife's alive. Yeah. So Mozart did die before finishing his Requiem. I was obsessed with this Requiem for a lot of my childhood, which is a weird thing to say, especially with you, like, pair it with my love of bats.
Oh, you little weirdo.
Oh, God. How did I have friends? But he was assisted in writing it down. Like, he was dictating it from his deathbed in the way that we see it in the film, but it was his wife and his student called Franz Sussmayr who were helping him write it down. He was dictating it to them. In the film, Mm-hmm. He dies from, I'm going to say, Salieri wanting him to die.
Yeah.
In the play and in like the opera and stuff, he dies from being poisoned, right? That's how Salieri kills Mozart. That doesn't really come across in the film. It seems like Salieri just wills him to die.
Yeah, or more like Salieri takes advantage. I think it's like Salieri is taking advantage of his situation, of like Mozart's situation and propensities and stuff like that, right? So, you know, he's like, aha, look at him, you know. He's already frivolous and spendthrift and an alcoholic, so I'm just gonna...
Can we say that he dies of death? That.
Yeah, oh my god, he dies of death! Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, so I would say either he dies of death,
mm-hmm.
or, I mean, similarly, this is dying of death adjacent, he dies from writing a requiem.
Yeah.
Which I think can cause death.
Talk about throwing yourself into your work, right? He's like, I can only understand what a proper requiem is going to be like if I'm actually dead.
Oh, that is such a low blow to Mozart. Talk about throwing yourself into your work. Too soon. So here's the thing. So recently, in the last few years, researchers, I don't know anything more specific than that, researchers have theorized that Mozart actually died from strep throat, which was going around Vienna at this time.
Oh my god, so I've had strep throat. I could have died.
You recently had strep throat as an adult, so you know how rubbish it is. I think I had strep throat as a child. It's horrible as a child. Apparently it's much worse as an adult. So as a 35-year-old, contracting strep throat, which apparently a lot of people did in Vienna in the winter of 1791. Strep throat can also come with a side of kidney problems. So he, according to some researchers, died of strep throat with a side of kidney failure. And you can learn more about that from the BBC podcast I listened to, Composer of the Week.
Yeah, all right.
One last thing about Mozart's death. Mozart is shown being buried in a mass grave and no one is there attending his gravesite. This was kind of half true. So the practice at the time was that people didn't really attend graveside burials. But when you talk about a common grave at the time, that wasn't a communal grave. So he wouldn't have been thrown in on top of a bunch of other people. A common grave was the name for an individual grave for common people, i.e. not members of the aristocracy. Right. So it depended on how much you paid. So he would have paid for like a third class grave, which meant that he would have been in an unmarked grave, which was then excavated for reuse after 10 years.
Okay.
So he got his own grave. But he didn't get a marker, and then he was dug up after 10 years so that someone else could be buried there. And that's why Constanza didn't know where he was buried when she tried to look for him 17 years later. And that's why we still don't know exactly where he's buried.
Oh.
So it wasn't that he was thrown in like a strep throat pit.
I just counted. I was 35 when I had strep throat. Like, for real, I just counted in my head. I did counting in my head. Yeah.
You could have done a Mozart.
I could have done a Mozart.
And weren't you working on your PhD at the time?
Mm-hmm, I was.
You could have been dictating it.
Exactly, from my deathbed.
And then, footnote. Cited from.
Yes.
So do we have time? Can I go back to Constanza?
Yeah. I want to know about her. She's cool.
You got to know about... Okay, so I really love Constanza in this film. I love that she's in it. Elizabeth Berridge plays her so well. I love the amount of Constanza that we get. We could have had even more. Not literally, because this film is 17 hours long. But there is more badassery to know about Constanza, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
So she actually was the daughter of Mozart's landlady. And so he came to Vienna from Salzburg. He went to go live with his family in a room that they were renting, pretty common. She was 19 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like 25, 26.
Mm.
And then the family found out that they had started liking each other and mm-hmm. maybe smooching. And so he had to go. He had to move out. Mm-hmm. So he went and lived in some other rooms. But then when Constanze was 20 and Mozart was 26, she caused a bit of a scandal when she left home and she went to go live with him. So she kind of pulled a Lydia Bennett.
Scandalous.
Like, she didn't run away with him because she was just in his apartment, but she ran away and went to live with him.
Ooh.
And so they had to get married real quick after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Papa Mozart, there's this whole thing about Papa Mozart not wanting him to marry her mm-hmm. in the film. He didn't really approve, but when Mozart wrote to him and said, she's pulled a Lydia Bennett and she's living with me now.
Mm.
He was like, who's Lydia Bennett? That book wasn't written until for another like 30 years. But he wrote back and said, like, it's fine. I consent to this marriage. And mm-hmm. he got that letter the day that they got married. So Papa Mozart did consent in the end. But Constanze, in addition to being a bit of a Lydia, she was a trained singer and a musician, so Mozart sometimes wrote stuff for her, like for her voice.
Oh, wow.
And she helped him with his compositions as well. Like, she wrote down stuff for him, including,
right,
you know,
okay.
on his deathbed. So she was often described in the stuff that I read and listened to. She was described as, like, in poor health, and that Mozart, you know, sent her a way to get medical mm-hmm. treatments, or she was getting these expensive medical treatments in Vienna. But that's kind of all I really learned about her. But in context, if you think about it, she also had six babies, six births in 9 years, and only two of those children survived infancy.
Oh my God.
So of course she was in poor health.
Jeez Louise, six babies in 9 years.
Six babies in 9 years, and it's the 1780s. People, she's not well.
No. I mean, so she could have died for any one of those.
Exactly. And then the trauma, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
So the kid that we see in the film, that's Carl Thomas. He was born mm-hmm. in 1784. And then Franz Xaver was born in 1791.
Mm-hmm.
So he was only 4 months old when Mozart died. And that's an element we don't see in the film. Her husband dies. Yeah. She's got a 4-month-old baby. And after this, she got a pension from the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
She remarried and she co-wrote Mozart's biography with her second husband. And then she lived into old age in a house that she shared with her two sisters.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, wow. All right. Costanzi.
Yeah. I had sort of a question. So Mozart was this musical genius.
Mm-hmm.
But he was born in a very particular time in the classical period in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
If he, with that same genius and that same family, were born today,
mm-hmm.
or let's say that he's 26 in the year 2023,
mm-hmm.
what do you think he would be up to? What would he be doing?
So he's a genius. Is he just an artistic genius?
No, he's not a musical genius specifically.
He's a musical
let's
genius.
Let's say as we see him in the film.
Right, so he's a musical genius.
He is this like divine voice of God. Take that opera writing savant prodigy and dunk him into 2023 as a 26-year-old. What's he up to?
Reading TikTok videos.
He's just reading TikTok videos. He's just sitting at home, like in his dad's basement, looking at TikTok videos.
Yep. No, no, no. He's creating them. He's not just looking at
them. That's not better. You think he's just a TikTok influencer?
Yes.
I mean no disrespect to TikTok influencers, yeah, but I don't think that's what Mozart would be doing.
What would he be doing? He would be creating musicals.
Musicals?
My young Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. But he didn't write any of the stuff. So when in the film, when they talk about librettos.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
The libretto, that's essentially like the play you write the opera music.
That's true.
He didn't write any of the librettos.
Oh, he could just be, he would be Dr. Dre. He'll be like.
No, like, not Dr. Like Dre.
I'm sorry, you started it with the whole Snoop Dogg thing. All right, now all I can think of is like.
What about.
No. He would be a. No, okay. Not Dr. Dre, but I think he would be an amazing music producer. Because that's what you need to do, right? You need to be able to see all of these things together, kind of combine it all.
What about film scores?
Okay. Yep.
Could he be like a Danny Elfman or
Hans Zimmer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he would definitely need, he would crave the public eye.
As I was going to say, right? Yeah. So he'll be like a bad boy version of that. Yeah. Going around, like paparazzi being, over him.
Loving his wife.
Mm-hmm.
A singer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. She'd be a singer. Okay. So I have an award, and my award is for best costume. I know they already won an award for best costume.
I believe it was an Oscar. Fine.
They won an Oscar for best costume. And I think the entire Oscar for best costume hinged on this one costume, which is clearly the unicorn. And I will repeat, the unicorn costume that Mozart wears to his little costume party.
Oh my gosh. We're in a fight. You and I are fighting right now. Oh no. Because my award is also for best costume.
No. Okay, which one? Is it like, I'm not Salieri?
It's the mustache finger.
Yes.
I'm not Count Franz. Yeah. It goes to Simon Callow, specifically in The Magic Flute, as a budgie.
Oh, that's cute.
You know that little duet that they do, where they're both little green budgies.
I know.
I never thought I could feel more joy about Simon Callow than when I saw him in A Room with a View, splishy splashing and showing the underside of his testicles, which I'm going to call the Simon Callow. Or maybe just the callow. Yeah. It's the callow.
The callow. It's just the callow.
The callow refers to the underside of one's, like the back side of one's ball sack. That sounds like really derogatory, but I mean it with the utmost love. Like that doesn't.
Yeah. That wonderful
that
callow,
doesn't
yeah.
have a name, that part of the anatomy, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And the most iconic depiction of it I can think of is Simon Callow's In a Room with a View, which we talk about in our episode on A Room with a View.
Yep, so go back and listen. Yeah.
But I felt a similar level of joy seeing Simon Callow as a budgie, especially when he came to Mozart's door, like really concerned as a budgie.
I know, that was really
a budgie
cute.
Who's really worried about his friends. It's like, this is one of my favorite Simon Callows.
Yeah. A budgie who's carrying his own cage. Like, I was like, no, budgie, you can't even run away. But yeah, all right, fair. I'll share that award with you.
Okay, yay, we can do it.
No fighting.
A double bus costume.
Yeah, awesome.
Thank you for joining us on our Amadeus episode.
Yes, and if you have any suggestions, you can hit us up on Instagram at Fetch Smelling Salts.
Or on our email at fetchsmellingsalts@gmail.com. We really would love to hear any kind of suggestions you have for period dramas that we can cover in the future. And
all right. And with that, I'm off to go look for some Snoop Dogg wine.
And I'm going to go eat some Mozart marzipan.
Oh, wonderful. All right. Good night.
Goodbye. It's all finished.